When he was in grad school, a professor assigned Thomas Chatterton Williams the job of writing an op-ed piece. What emerged was an impassioned critique of hip-hop culture's effect on Black Americans. As an African-American man himself, Williams has absorbed the message of hip-hop as a young boy in high school, and it's a message he said can be condensed to money, hoes, and clothes, to keeping it real at the expense of education. The piece eventually ran in the Washington Post and generated a huge response, and later became the book we're talking about today. It's called Losing My Cool: How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. Thomas Chatterton Williams joins us today, and we'd love to hear from you. Is hip-hop holding back Black Americans? And when you absorb hip-hop, do you take it with a dose of irony? And what about the positive aspects of hip-hop, the democracy and the self-expression? The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Thomas Chatterton Williams, so glad you could join us this morning.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, when your professor assigned you that op-ed piece, did you already know that you were going to write about hip-hop?
No, I didn't. I went to the library and I kind of thought, what will I write about? What do I really care about? And I was thinking a lot about Black culture in general at those times. I was reading a lot of James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, and I was listening to a lot of John Coltrane and Miles Davis, and I kind of just thought, you know, there's a discrepancy between this culture, this Black culture from the last century that I'm kind of really fascinated by and growing to appreciate and growing to learn about, and there's a real discrepancy between that and the culture that I grew up in. And I felt, you know, in certain ways, the culture I grew up in has cheated me when I compare it to Invisible Man or to Giant Steps or A Love Supreme, or when I compare it, as I start to think more, when I compare it to my own father. And so I wrote, you know, in about a couple of hours, I banged out a piece that basically made the point, saying that Black culture in the hip-hop era, the past 30, 35 years, has increasingly become Black street culture, and to the neglect of many other things that used to be valued.
Well, when we talk about hip-hop, most of us think about, you know, music, Jay-Z, mm-hmm. Tupac Shakur, but you're making the argument that this is much broader than music. Mm-hmm. This has become mm-hmm. a culture, and you've called it street culture. It's parceled up in that, but let's be clear. How would you exactly describe hip-hop culture?
Okay, I think it's really a kind of a secular religion. It governs everything that many Blacks under the age of nowadays 45, it governs everything that we do, from the way we walk, greet each other, reach for a piece of food. I was walking to get a cup of coffee this morning, and outside of my building in Brooklyn, and there was a photo shoot going down for there was a teenager who was sort of up-and-coming rapper, and the way that he was posed was just, it's a prefabricated idea of a way a Black guy is supposed to stand in the street. It's a cookie-cutter idea of what is real. And so the music is just a single aspect of it. It's the soundtrack to a lifestyle and a system of values, but it's, for me, it's not the main focal point.
Well, what is the system of values as you see it?
Well, I think that it's both what you value and what you don't value. So I write a lot in the book about the fact that, for instance, playing sports is something to be valued. And I grew up very serious about basketball. Basketball was the big deal in New Jersey when I was coming up in the 80s and 90s. And so that was cool. Developing your body was cool. Developing your mind was not cool, and it wasn't that people had to explicitly say so, but it was that if you were spending too much time with books, if you were trying too hard in school, if you were talking a certain way, that was associated with being white, which was not real, which was not Black.
And you said that this culture, as you see it, shortchanges Black Americans.
I think so, and not just in the school, but also when it comes to the way that we think about how a man should behave towards a woman. I write in the book a lot about the way that my friends and I just felt such pressure to to be players, because as a black guy, you were supposed to have a certain type of swagger and proficiency with women that that didn't allow you to enter into kind of meaningful and equal relationships with them. You had to be running game.
And is this true for, you know, say, white kids, Hispanic kids, any kid who might be young going to school? Because hip-hop is a dominant force right mm-hmm. now, certainly musically, and the culture, I guess, in some aspects, too. What about the cross-cultural mm-hmm. aspects of hip-hop? Or is it just true for black Americans?
I think there's a singular, pretty unique way that that it works on black youth, but I obviously there are a lot of parallels and similarities with Latino culture in many parts of the country, and that's kind of and blacks and Latinos have some similar experiences, but in terms of white kids and other kinds of non-black kids, I don't think that it worked on us the same way. I think that white kids were able to always kind of have a certain type of detachment that saved them from the perils of the culture that many of us fell victim to. So they were able to engage with it, ironically, I say in the book. And by that I simply mean that they were able to separate what is being said, the message, and what is literally meant. And I think that for many blacks, there was never any difference between what is being said and intended and what is meant and what we're supposed to do and emulate. So the thing that we were most earnest and serious about was keeping it real, even when the reality, the model of reality we're trying to emulate was not our own. We were emulating a ghetto reality, a criminal, a street reality, or a fantasized hip-hop reality, but we were living in decent homes, and our parents were trying hard to send us to school so that we could get an education. So I think that a little bit of ironic detachment might have saved some of us from class thinking, from emulating drug dealers and hustlers.
Well, when you were growing up, hip-hop culture was really attractive to you. You know, your mother is white, your father black, mm-hmm. and growing up, there came a point where you were worried about whether you were black enough. There was a moment when you were in a car with your family, and you felt like you were spotted out by a woman, and it made you embarrassed, and it seemed as though that was a turning point for turning to the hip-hop culture that, you know, you later discarded. But talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I was like 9 years old. And I was going to the barbershop. We lived in a kind of a mixed town, and then right next to us was a predominantly black town. And so we were driving into the black part, the black town, Plainfield, so I could get my hair cut with my brother. And my mother was driving, and my family, we were never affluent, but we had a used Mercedes-Benz, and we used to get a lot of, we used to catch all types of hell for that car, because the white kids knew it was used, the black kids thought we were rich and would tease us for that. But going to the barbershop, there was a woman who was on her balcony, I remember, and she was holding a baby, and she was pacing the balcony. She was very upset. She was smoking a cigarette, and I mean, we were stopped at a red light, and I must have just been staring at her. I'd never seen, you know, something quite like that, I guess. I was really young, and all of a sudden I realized she was just yelling and screaming, and I was making out what she was saying, and she was screaming at us. In fact, she was screaming at my mother and saying that, you know, us white people couldn't just drive through her neighborhood and just stare at her like she was some animal in the zoo. And I was wondering why is she calling us white people? You know, I was always raised, my father and my mother always raised us to be black and to be proud of being black, and we never questioned that we were black. And I was wondering why I was being questioned for being black, or why I was being fingered out as being white. And so when I got to the barbershop, and over the course of repeated trips to the barbershop, I started paying more and more attention to the other black boys in the barbershop, and more attention to BET, Black Entertainment Television, that was playing on the TV station, on the TV in the barbershop. And I started thinking, you know, I need to get my hair cut in certain ways. I need to make sure that no one ever mistakes me again.
And hip-hop seemed to be a key part of that for you. So mm-hmm. how did that play out for you in your life before college?
Well, I was pretty engrossed in it, and I write a lot about the fact that in high school, something that really kind of made me feel that my life was as it should be was the type of girl that I dated, and so I dated a girl who was pretty, and she was kind of fast, and she had a lot of street credibility, if you will, and she was the object of desire for a lot of drug dealers in the neighborhood, and so I felt that having her was a kind of a prize. And then I got to the point where I was fortunate enough that my father stayed on me to the point that I got into some good schools, and I went to Georgetown, and I came back after my freshman year, and I remember my high school girlfriend Stacy just thought that I had just completely sold out, or I'd become so lame in her eyes, and she hadn't taken the SATs or even bothered to apply to college, and so she told me that she was pregnant by a drug dealer that she had been seeing while I was in college, and so we kind of just split that way, and I think that was really the last moment in my life where I had any tie to the kind of hip-hop culture and lifestyle we've been talking about.
Well, and you credit your dad with being this incredible force in your life, mm-hmm. this positive force who really, you know, when other kids were playing, he had you come home and hit the books right away. He was an SAT or mm-hmm. a college prep test teacher, and he trained you in that. He was gearing up to get you into college the whole time that you were growing up. Tell us a little bit about your dad.
Sure. My dad is... my whole life, he's run an academic preparation business out of the house, mainly teaching SAT tests and the GRE and the LSAT and things like that. But he's a sociologist by training. He has a PhD in sociology, and prior to doing this, he was he worked in the war on poverty and ran anti-poverty programs from Los Angeles all the way to Newark, New Jersey, where I was born and where we ended up. And he was born in the 30s. He was born in 1937 in the segregated South in Texas. And so when he was coming up, he became very committed very early to this idea that he was pretty much in a bad spot as a black man, and you know, in the Jim Crow South, and the only way that he was going to ever make it was if he tried to absorb as much knowledge as he could, and where he lived, no one was educated. Where he lived, the source of knowledge was books, so he made books and the acquisition of books his passion. So growing up, our house was filled with books, thousands and thousands of books in a very small home, and so it was part of who we were, that in our free time we studied with my father. It was not a choice. And so I kind of had this double identity and double life where I never showed that side of myself to my peer group, to my friends in high school. I hid that, except for with one boy who was one of the coolest kids in school. And we just clicked early on, and he began coming over to my house for years every day after school. And my father kind of treated him like another son, and the two of us studied day in and day out together, and that was kind of our little secret.
There's a really neat story in your book where you bring someone home. I'm not sure if it's the friend Charles you're talking mm-hmm. about or someone else, but your dad asks him how he did at some test or something, and he turns out he did pretty well. So your dad reaches in his pocket and pulls out some money.
Friends, yeah.
Tell us the rest of that story, would you?
Sure. Well, that was one of my brother's friends who was not a good kid, but my dad he tried to help everybody. Anyone who came in the house, he tried to sit with them and talk with them and encourage them to do as well as they could in school and to read more. So this kid came in, and he was about 5 years older than me. I was like 12 at the time. He comes in the house and says he got an A on some test in school, and I really doubted that because I don't even think he was going to school. But you know, and I don't think that my dad really bought it either, but you know, he reached in his pocket and he took out what loose cash he had, and he gave it to him. He told him that he was proud of him and to keep up the good work. And I remember after the kid left, I said, "Why would you give? You know, I really didn't like this kid. I said, why would you give him anything? You know, he's not worth it." And my dad just kind of he was really tired. He had been teaching all day, and he took his glasses off and just looked at me and said, you know, because maybe no one ever has given him anything, you know, and it was just as simple as that. And he kind of just went in the kitchen and asked my mom what was for dinner, and that was that. And I kind of thought about that a lot.
You make it in the book sort of sound like this tug of war between your dad, who had these beautiful goals for you, and this other culture, which you see is kind of, I guess, kind of tugging on your ankle and dragging you down a bit.
Yeah, I think it was a tug of war. I mean, ultimately, I think that I was very fortunate because my father planted, and my mother as well, they planted ideas and seeds in me that I wasn't even aware were growing. And so I was fortunate. I don't know that I would have necessarily gotten myself prepared the way I needed to be to get into Georgetown and to go to grad school, were I left to my own devices. I have a lot of friends who I think are as smart as anyone I've ever met anywhere, but they never realized their potential. So it's sobering to think back on the fact that my dad and my mother were engaged in a tug of war with a culture that I think levels down far too many of us.
Well, and when you published this piece in the Washington Post, there was a pretty passionate response. On the one hand, mm-hmm. there were a lot of people who agreed with you in your critique of hip-hop and that it did drag down black Americans. On the other hand, there were a lot of people who said, no, wait a minute, you've got that wrong. Hip-hop is a positive thing, and you're blaming, you know, the victim here.
That's right. And sometimes it's surprising who is making what argument. Got a lot of angry feedback from whites, actually, which surprised me, saying that I was out of touch with black reality and that I was blaming the victim. And then I got a lot of, and I continue to this day to get a lot of feedback from black people across the country who are thanking me for and saying that they agree with what I'm saying and that they too have been frustrated for so long with so many of these things. Obviously, I get a lot of criticism from blacks in the hip-hop generation and blacks my age who just dismiss my argument on its face. But I'm pretty surprised by how many hip-hop generation, die-hard hip-hop fans tell me that there are aspects of the argument that they agree with. So, I think that the book has generated some passionate feedback, but less than the op-ed piece because it's, at book length, the argument is allowed to be more nuanced.
Well, in terms of hip hop, you know, it is not just one thing or the other thing, because if you look at a lot of hip hop, it's being used to express sentiments sort of in poetry form, in poetry slams. There's the democratic aspect of it, where anybody can have a voice, and the aspect that it's this great vehicle for self-expression. What about that aspect of hip-hop?
Right. And, you know, I mean, I think that's a valid point. And, you know, certainly what I'm talking about when I'm talking about hip-hop culture and street culture is not, what I have in mind is not really the roots or spoken word poets or people like that. But what I try to make very clear is that those people do not steer or govern the culture for most hip-hop generation blacks. So they exist, and there's kind of great stuff going on, and there is the poetic aspect, and there's the, you know, the artistic element. But the type of conscious and democratic forms of the culture you're talking about are not the driving force behind it. And the main thread, as I look back on the black culture that I was shaped by, the main thread was not poetry or artistry. It was a kind of idea about street credibility and being real, which I think on the whole is negative. So hip-hop could be more than that, but hip-hop as it is lived and practiced often falls short.
Well, we need to take our first break right now. This hour, we're talking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, who's the author of the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. And we'd love to hear from you. Take your phone call this morning. Do you think hip-hop is holding back black Americans? And when you absorb hip-hop, do you take it with a dose of irony? And what about the positive aspects of hip-hop? We'd love to hear what you think about that as well. Our number, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Tuesday morning. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning we're talking with Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's joining us and talking about his new book called Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. And we'll take our first phone call right now. We have Marcus joining us from Appleton. Hi, Marcus.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I'm wondering, isn't this more of a socioeconomic, shouldn't the lines be drawn socioeconomically rather than by race, saying it's a black thing where it's more of a poor thing? And to not get too off topic, I'm just thinking that historically, people who have felt socioeconomically repressed have always come out with music and violence to promote their culture to move ahead, and this is just another occurrence of it in our history.
Marcus, can you give us an example of a culture that's used music and violence to move ahead?
The Irish threw 5 points in New York when they were coming over to America.
Hmm.
Italians building the mob. The United States founding free religion by having a war.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call. What do you think, Thomas Chatterton Williams? Should we be drawing socioeconomic lines?
Well, I think that I want to respond to both parts of what the caller said. The first thing is that in terms of socioeconomic factors certainly exist, but what I'm talking about is culture, and I think that one of the most important aspects of this book is that I'm saying that culture matters, and that I'm not just talking about poor blacks. In fact, I'm not talking about poor blacks primarily. I'm talking about middle-class blacks feeling the need to be authentically black by emulating poor blacks, which is a cultural problem. It's not that we lacked material possessions. It's that we lacked a culture that prized celebrating achievement and celebrating the mind and these types of things. It had nothing to do with the fact that I didn't grow up poor, and nor did my peer group. And most blacks are not poor, actually. The majority of blacks live above the poverty line. So the idea that we're talking about poor blacks in the ghetto is false. The other idea that that poor people have always created cultures of music and violence is false, too. And when you look back at the history of black culture in America, we didn't have this history of violence and celebrating violence until really recently. You look at the blues, you look at the slave hymns. These were people who were going through incredible trials and tribulations and who were incredibly poor, impoverished, kept ignorant. And their songs were songs of sorrow, but also of uplift and strength and discipline. And they weren't gangsters. They weren't outlaws, and they weren't that wasn't what they aspired to be. So we don't have to look beyond the black tradition to see that hip hop in many ways has degraded the kind of triumph of the spirit that black people had celebrated for most of our history here.
Does that answer your points, Marcus? Oh, I think we just lost Marcus there. Well, thank you for that call, and we'll move on now to Tyrone with us from Appleton. Hi, Tyrone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning.
I just got a comment. I was wondering, I'm also a biracial male. My father's black. My mom is white. I'm 27. I lived a pretty well-rounded life. You can say I've been there, done that, been to prison, been to college. What my comment was I was wondering, since you are biracial, were you just trying to find maybe who you were in life, and that's why you were emulating what you were seeing through hip-hop, just instead of taking it in as just entertainment? You just thought that you were emptiness and just didn't know who you were.
Sure. No, well, I try to, in the book, illustrate that it wasn't a biracial problem. All my friends were fully black, so I was having the same problems they were having. They were trying to keep it real as hard as I was. They were trying to live up to an expectation of blackness as hard or harder than I was. It wasn't about compensating for a white parent. That really wasn't a main defining factor. The kids who kept it the realest were kids with two black parents.
Well, hip-hop is still going strong right now in terms of cultural force.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the long-term effect of that is going to be?
If it keeps going as it is, I think we're going to keep having, we're going to be 20 years, if nothing changes in the culture, 20 years from now, we'll still be having, trying to get together and have Al Sharpton, the next Al Sharpton, organize meetings about why black people still have an achievement gap, because the culture that's promoted is one that's never going to close the achievement gap. As long as we celebrate ignorance and kind of penalize intellectual achievement, and as long as we have 7 out of 10 babies being born out of wedlock and celebrate a player lifestyle, you know, as long as Puff Daddy is on TV setting the tone for the culture and talking about the fact that he has 6 children by 6 different women and that's considered okay, then we're going to have a lot of these same problems. But, you know, I'm not completely pessimistic. I think that there's nothing more powerful that's happened recently in black culture than the fact that a really admirable black family occupies the White House. And I think that 5, 10, 20 years from now, we're going to be seeing ramifications of just how powerful a symbol that is, and the fact that black kids who never knew that they could even shoot for those kinds of goals are now going to be shooting to go to Harvard and to write their own books and to speak well in a way that has nothing to do with hip-hop.
I'm wondering if you've gotten any jobs speaking to, you know, maybe back at your own high school, talking about what else is available.
I've done some speaking as I've been promoting the book, and I look forward to doing more of it. I haven't, no one from my old high school has reached out to me, but I'm not sure I paint my old high school in the best light either, so.
Well, I'm curious, you know, in your book you contrast hip-hop with, say, Nina Simone, the Harlem Renaissance, mm-hmm. James Baldwin, and those things are available. They're still there. You can listen, you can read. But do you think that there's something about hip-hop now that eclipses those other aspects of black culture and makes them unavailable?
I do. I think that, you know, I'm certain that, you know, there's no one black experience, and I'm talking about the black experience that I grew up with and observed. But for my friends and me and for many blacks that I've met in the hip-hop generation, black culture really started in the 70s. It started in the South Bronx with DJ Kool Herc, and it really got going with the Sugar Hill Gang in 79. And we don't really think about what existed prior to that. I talk in the book about just simple things like the fact that my friends and I growing up in and around Plainfield, New Jersey, had no idea that Parliament Funkadelic, that George Clinton was from Plainfield, New Jersey. We just knew that some of his songs were used to make stuff we were really interested in, which was Dr. Dre's beats and Snoop Doggy Dogg's beats. We didn't know that this whole other kind of black music had thrived all around us. We didn't know much about the Harlem Renaissance. My friends had not read the autobiography of Malcolm X. We didn't know who James Baldwin was. We couldn't have told you the difference between a John Coltrane song and a Miles Davis song. We didn't know that John Coltrane played the sax and Thelonious Monk played the piano. That was almost as unreal to us as white culture. The only real black culture and the only real way of expressing your blackness was through hip hop or sports.
Let's take another phone call here. We've got Willie with us from Madison. Hi, Willie.
Hi. In years when I was working as a bus driver, I got plenty of opportunity to spend some time chatting with young African Americans. And some of the things that surprised me, these were mostly probably middle school age or high school age, how seldom they knew about people like Sojourner Truth, people mm-hmm. like Harriet Tubman. You've mentioned some of the tremendous cultural achievements. You know, there's any really lopsided thing other than the fact that so many black people are in prison compared to white people. All of Americans' cultural export kind of stuff is so overwhelmingly African-American in mm-hmm. its origin, all of the music and stuff. Something they should be very proud of, you know. Anybody who says black people haven't contributed to American culture is really crazy or bigoted. Are there places where young African Americans can get better educated about the very proud history of that they have of resistance, of intellectual and other and scientific accomplishments? You know, within the larger American culture, I've always been surprised at how they don't seem to know a lot about that.
Right, and I thank you for bringing that up, because one of the biggest American cultural achievements in our history is jazz music, and that's an African American form, and the whole world recognize that. Hip hop is also a form that the whole world recognizes, but I'm not sure it stands up to jazz. But to answer your question, I think that the place where young blacks can get educated about the breadth and the wealth of their history is really in books. And the idea that that we need to really befriend books and spend our time with books has to be promoted more. And I think that, you know, the only way that will happen is if more black writers, intellectuals, public figures, and just everyday people of goodwill really challenge the dominant narrative of what blackness is and offer up viable alternatives. And so we have to be writing about the fact that hip-hop culture, while it might be a valid expression of blackness, is only one expression and is necessarily limited in its purview. So more people have to really take it upon themselves to expose the black tradition and blackness in all its variety.
Well, thanks for the call, Willie. And we move on to Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
I'm a music guy myself. I spent quite a lot of time in Los Angeles and Minneapolis, and I got kind of thrown into the hip-hop culture myself, just kind of out of nowhere. Grew up on a farm, whatever. And music is a big influential thing in hip-hop culture, as is, you know, clothing and, you know, several things. And I'd like to hear some more on what you think are some influential factors in hip-hop culture.
Sure. Well, music is obviously really influential, and the clothing is too. I spent some time writing about the fact that I was able to change almost overnight the way that I was performing in college when I decided to make a very definite change in the way that I was dressing and kind of presenting myself in the world. It changed the way I felt and thought about myself. It feels good to look good. It feels tough to look tough. It feels smart to look smart. So dressing like gangsters and emulating gangsters, I think, works in deeper ways than just the surface level. When you dress the same exact way as the drug dealer on your block, you feel an association with him. When you listen to the exact same songs and you both have the same thoughts and the same noises fill your heads, you're linked to that person in certain ways. In addition to that, I think that kind of the speech and the language, in addition to the music and the clothing, is really powerful, and it links a lot of people, the slang. So if you're speaking in the same ways, in the same terms, you share a language with people that you might not necessarily want to share a fate with. That's powerful, and that works, you know, to keep everybody kind of connected.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Paul. And we'll take another break right now and come back. Hopefully we'll be talking to more of you as we discuss the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture, written by our guest this morning, Thomas Chatterton Williams. And give us a call this morning. What do you think? Is hip-hop holding back black Americans? And what about the more positive aspects of hip-hop? Our number, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard, back with you this Tuesday morning here on the Ideas Network as we talk with guest Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's the author of the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. Taking our next call now, we have Joe joining us from Rockland. Welcome, Joe.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to, thank your guest. I'm from a large family. We're a white family, but three of my youngest brothers are black and adopted. And we have had a difficult time. The youngest are twins, they're 13, and they've adopted the attitude that they have to be like the rappers. They have to be a part of that culture, and that we don't understand them because we're white. Having a difficult time approaching that subject because their response to any approach we have is, you're white, you don't understand. And listening to this program, I had to call my mom right away. I said, we got to get this book. You got to get online, try and find this interview, because I'm very happy to hear somebody explain these things in such a way that I can that we can approach my younger siblings with.
Well, thank you for your call, Joe. And Thomas Chatterton Williams, what would you say to Joe?
Yeah, well, I want to thank him for his call too. It reminds me of a moment in my own life where, you know, I was playing basketball at the park as I often did, and I was really looking up to the older kids who were there, and some of them were drug dealers, and they were the coolest guys around. And I remember going home and telling my mom, just I was 12 or 13, and telling my mom, you know, when I have kids, I'm going to give my kids real black names, you know, not white names like Thomas. And I remember just like the kind of the pain that flashed across her face. And since that moment, I've kind of been sensitive to the fact that white family members of blacks can feel, you know, can feel that they can't bridge this cultural gap. And so I don't know that I have a prescriptive thing to say to Joe, other than I understand the kind of interaction he's talking about, and I hope that you know, as his little brothers grow up, that that they're able to define themselves as widely as possible and realize that they have things in common with people across cultural lines.
Appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. Good luck. And I want to talk about something we touched on earlier, the election of Barack Obama, you say you think is going to have big ripple effects down the road for blacks coming of age. What do you think is going to happen there, and what do you see happening already?
I'm sorry, with Barack Obama?
With Barack Obama being elected, uh-huh.
Well, I think that symbolism is extremely important. And so I think that the image of a black man, the most famous black man now, in the world, is not an entertainer, and he's not an athlete, but he's not just a politician. He's a thinker and a writer, and he's also not somebody who's ever kind of denied his blackness or tried to act as though he was dissociating himself with that. So I think for many, that's going to be a source of great pride and inspiration. And so I think that that's powerful. Ideas and culture are powerful. And so I personally, you know, I was inspired by his candidacy and volunteered for it. And as I traveled the country campaigning for him, I saw this look in a lot of eyes that said that, you know, we've always been told that, you know, things are fine and we're equal, but actually seeing it makes a huge difference.
Well, going back to hip-hop for a moment, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, if you look at someone like Tupac Shakur, who you hold up in your book as an example kind of this street culture or thug culture, people write dissertations on Tupac Shakur mm-hmm. and on the poetry of hip-hop. And do you ever worry, I guess, about dismissing too much of the culture and not sort of savoring, you know, the points that are being celebrated right now?
No, I don't. I think that there's a lot kind of wrong with the higher education system, and a lot of things are taught in colleges and universities, and a lot of dissertations are written on subjects that aren't necessarily equal with the greatest learning, you know, and the greatest intellectual tradition. So I don't know that college courses on Tupac Shakur or the poetry of hip hop are necessarily valuable. To be honest, I think that if you want to study poetry, you can look at poetry. If you want to study African American literature, Black literature, we have really important examples of that that get too little attention. I don't think that Tupac Shakur is in danger of not getting enough attention, but I do think that not enough blacks or whites are exposed to the essays of James Baldwin in the year 2010. So I don't understand why, I guess, in the university we're making more time to teach more mass culture and more popular music and ideas that are not really the most challenging or maybe even the most important.
Let's take another phone call now. We have with us Dane from Chicago. Hi, Dane.
Hi, how are you?
Good,
thanks
how are you?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to make a point and kind of get your input on it. You know, I think there's good and bad for all social mediums, but I do think that it's the responsibility of the parents to kind of raise the child. You know, I don't see how we can blame hip-hop any more than we can blame television, any more than we can blame movies, any more than we can blame books, for that matter, because they're all kind of social mediums. There's good and bad for rock and roll. There's good and bad for hip-hop. You know, Dr. Dre rapped about, you know, big-screen TVs and mansions, and Tupac, yeah, I mean, he rapped about his mom. So those are good aspects. Are there bad aspects, too? Absolutely. And, you know, but that's where the responsibility of the parent comes in to say, hey, that's wrong. That's not the way that things are. So I think that there's good and bad aspects of all kind of social mediums, and I kind of wanted to get your input on that.
All right. Thanks, Dane.
Well, I completely agree with that. The most important factor in anybody's life is going to be the immediate family unit, and the parents are of the primary importance. And so, you know, there's nothing in my, there's no message in my book more important than that parenting matters. But I would say that hip-hop, an essential point I'm trying to make is that hip-hop is not social media or just another genre of music. It's a lived culture, and it influences African-American, black culture more than, in a disproportionate way, more powerfully than rock and roll ever influenced white culture. It affects and governs black life in a more dominant way. There's not an example of another culture I can think of to compare it to. It's the only thing I can compare it to is a religion, because it governs every aspect of life, not just what you're listening to. It's not that Dr. Dre raps about something. It's that there's a whole way of being that his raps simply provide a soundtrack for.
Do you think there's a way to change hip-hop from within instead of sort of tossing the whole thing out, to have rappers, you know, someone from the Black Eyed Peas writing about, I don't know, something more socially responsible or education? Is that what you'd like to see?
Well, here's the thing. The fact that many people don't always talk about, the fact of the matter is that hip-hop music and culture was created in the black ghetto by lower-class blacks. That's just a fact. So the culture is always going to reflect, if it's going to be authentic, the hip-hop culture has to reflect a street aesthetic, and it has to reflect a street reality. It came from the streets. It would change into something else if it didn't keep itself grounded in the black inner city. So I'm not sure that were it to change, it would be something else. And it's not to say that poor blacks or lower class blacks are bad. It's simply to say that should all blacks be getting their cues from the South Bronx? Should black culture be so overwhelmingly driven by the South Bronx and by Compton and by, you know, by Brooklyn? I'm not sure that it should.
But art forms are generally they're liquid. They change.
Mm-hmm.
They evolve. Why not change within the hip-hop? You're saying it has to happen. It wouldn't essentially be hip-hop anymore. Is that what you're saying?
I think you would change. Exactly. I think that it wouldn't be hip-hop anymore. It might be similar to hip-hop, but hip-hop itself has to keep a certain type of identity in the inner city. It has to be based in that. Otherwise, it's something else. I mean, it'd be some other form of spoken word or something.
Another phone call now. Let's go to Kurt, who's joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank
morning.
You. I'm wondering if the guest has some explanation for the economics of hip-hop as a entertainment form. There's hundreds of millions of dollars working through the system for this form of entertainment, and I'm sure that it's not all exploitative, even though just to make money. There has to be that element, but where does the money start, and where is it going, and what keeps it all in operation?
Sure, then that's a good thing to point out. I mean, hip hop for many years has been a billion-dollar industry, and it created the first black billionaire in the owner and founder of Black Entertainment Television, and it's created a few moguls like Russell Simmons and Puff Daddy and Jay-Z. Who they may very well end up as billionaires as well, and so you have a business model that that blacks are benefiting from more than they've benefited from any other cultural creation. Blacks never were financially rewarded for jazz or for the blues the way that they are for hip hop, and so that's the powerful incentive to do what sells and to ultimately sell stereotypes of your people in your culture back to them. And he asked where the money starts. We've known for a long time that that most hip-hop albums are sold to whites in the suburbs, and so that raises other questions about what it is about these kind of stereotypical images of black life that is so appealing to mainstream American culture. That's a real question. Why do so many whites respond with their pocketbooks and want to buy into this idea of blacks as thugs and criminals and players and gangsters?
Well, do you have an answer for that?
Well, I mean, I have ideas about it. I don't know that there is a definitive answer, but I know that there's always been a fascination with kind of, Norman Mailer wrote The White Negro. There's always been a fascination with kind of breaking the laws of propriety by emulating what's perceived to be bad, and what's and bad is embodied in the Negro or in the outlaw, and so so maybe there's a bit of seduction in that, but I think that it's powerfully harmful to allow that to be the image of blackness that's sold and marketed by blacks who are profiting off of it around the world. So, you have Africans in Africa who have never met an African American but have ideas about what it means to be black, and they think that it means to pack a gun and to kill each other. You have Japanese kids who have never met a black man, who have no idea who Ralph Ellison was, but they have very clear ideas of what it means to live in Brooklyn and to shoot somebody or to slam dunk. So I think that it's terribly irresponsible that blacks who control the culture allow these to be the images that are sold to people who are all too willing to consume them or who are too lazy to fact check them.
We're winding down on the end of the hour here, and I want to come back to your father, because in many ways this book is a love letter to your father,
mm-hmm.
and what he did for you, and I wonder how he responded to your book.
My father is pretty proud of, he's proud that I've become a writer, and he's proud that I think more than anything that I've, in writing this book, that I've put in a lot of the kind of ideas and philosophy that we've talked about for years. So this book is about hip hop and it's about black culture, but it's also about literature. It's about just what it means to read and think and kind of try to live the life of the mind, and beyond that, it's about just the struggle we all go through to define ourselves and not to be defined by the group we happen to belong to. And so that's a universal problem, and that I've tried, in my own way to address a universal problem, I think makes my father feel that the work was worthwhile, and so he's told me that he's proud of me, and that's about the best reward I can possibly have.
Have you thought about how you would raise your own children? I don't know if you have any now, but
I don't have children. But I've thought a lot about that, and I worry a lot about the type of culture and world that they would be growing up in. And I think that you'd have to be extremely vigilant to guard. My parents were extremely vigilant, and still it was a lopsided battle. They were up against terrible odds, and I don't know that it's gotten any better.
Well, we'll leave it there, but it's been a real pleasure to talk with you this morning. Enjoyed your book. Thanks for being on with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thomas Chatterton Williams is the author of the book Losing My Cool, How a Father's Love and 15,000 Books Beat Hip-Hop Culture. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in all this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And tomorrow, I hope you'll join us as we talk with Pat Benatar, the female rock icon. We'll be talking with her tomorrow. And on Friday, looking at the story of Custer's Last Stand with Nathaniel Philbrick. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.